And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and it's my pleasure to not only welcome back frequent guest, best-selling novelist Mark Greaney to the program, but also his co-author, the newly retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel Hunter Ripley Rollins IV, who goes by Rip. Rip served over 22 years in the Corps, having been deployed 10 times to combat and peacekeeping missions. Together, they have written Red Metal, a near-future military thriller in which their version of the Russian government launches a series of attacks on Western forces that they believe essential to maintaining and improving Mother Russia's strength and relevancy on the international stage. Red Metal is published by Berkeley. Mark, how did you and Colonel Rollins meet?
I was working on a Tom Clancy novel in 2014 and met Rip up at the Pentagon, and we became really good friends. He's a good writer, hadn't been published yet, and we talked about books, and I would go hang out with him, and we'd have beers, and I met his family, and then he was stationed out at Camp Pendleton in California, and I was out there doing research on the next Clancy book, and we spent some time together, and the whole time we were talking about ideas for stories or whatever. And then after a couple years of us knowing one another, I just sort of said, there's something here. We should do something together.
Now, you've worked with a more experienced writer, with Tom Clancy. What's it like working with a newer writer?
It's different in the collaboration sense. Like, Rip and I were as close collaborators as one can possibly be. I mean, down to the word, sending things back to each other and calling each other with ideas, or should I do this or should I do that. We made a really long outline for this book just so we would both be on the same page. And then we kind of went our separate ways and started writing, but we were always in communication and stuff like that. So contrasting that to the Tom Clancy work, which, you know, he was in Baltimore, I was in Memphis, and it was a little bit more removed. Rip and I, you know, I'd go up to D.C., we went on research trips together and stuff like that. So it was very different.
So what was the division of labor like, Rip?
I interviewed Larry Bond for my website, and I asked him the same question about how it was writing with Tom Clancy. And he said each author really needs to be willing to write about 60% of a novel to get 100%. I think if Mark and I thought about it, maybe we each wrote 75 or 80% of a novel, because we ended up throwing out a lot. We had about 247,000 words by the time we were done, and the publisher wanted us to cut it down to 200. So we ended up kind of whinging a little bit. We ended up with 217,000 words, but it was a labor of love. We really enjoyed it.
What did they want you to pare back on?
It wasn't really content. We got a really nice message back from Tom Colgan over at Penguin, and he said, "I love all this." I mean, his specific words were, "I really enjoy all this. I don't know what to cut. Figure it out." So that was kind of the process. But I don't know, it was a fantastic collaborative process. Mark is not only a very proficient writer, but he's got the readers very much in mind. So I don't know. I think at one point, Mark said during the collaborative process, since I was new, he said, "You know, Rip, I don't want to sound like Yoda here, but I need you to look at chapter 45. I said, "Well, that's okay, because if you're Yoda, that makes me Luke, so I'm good with that one."
I mean, we ended up cutting out some of the characterization. There's so many characters in this book, and we wanted there to be some depth in each of them as much as you can for a story this broad and big. But when it was time to pare things back, it's like, all right, so we have this guy who's really only in one scene wearing sandals because he's got a bunion. You know, it's like, I think we can keep the sandals, take out the bunion, and we just shave five words off. You do that over the course of a 650-page book, and you pare it back.
Yeah. Rip, what's it like taking notes from an editor as opposed to orders from a superior officer?
You know, it's funny because they're not dissimilar. In the Marine Corps, we have what are called mission-type orders, and mission-type orders is where your commander really trusts you and says, I understand that you've had, you know, 10, 15, 20 years of experience in the military, so I'm just going to give you general guidance. And that's what Tom and Mark did, which was really nice, because Mark would come in and say, you know, I've read over chapter 45, and I'm having a little problem with this, and I need you to fix it by Monday. For me, as kind of an older guy, that was nice. It was better than, you know, line number 10 has a split infinitive. What's wrong with you? So it was really nice in that sense.
Mark has done tons of research with military intelligence people, but did he make any mistakes that made you laugh because he didn't quite know the inside?
That's a good question. I mean, I'd have to say no. I mean, neither of us really did this. I mean, really what I learned from Mark was how to do on-location research. So he would take us to a certain environment. He went to France and researched some characters. We both went to Germany together. I'm sorry, he went to Poland. I went to France. And then we both visited Nellis Air Force Base. And so we had a preconceived idea of how the story arc was going to go. And then when we went to these locations, what I learned from Mark was, here's how you kind of fill in the blanks. There's going to be a fair amount that you're going to see. I mean, one kind of side note that I thought was really neat, we were both up at the highest peak in Germany called Zugspitze. It's a German peak that's over 9,700 feet high. We were up there looking around because we figured something needs to happen up here. We had kind of an idea of what it was going to be. But then all of a sudden we got kind of socked in by this snowstorm. I mean, it just showed up over us. It blew over the mountain. We couldn't see each other. Mark's, you know, Rip, are you there? I'm like, I'm here, man. Where are you? And then it was gone. I mean, it was there for, I don't know, 20, 30 seconds or something. And we both looked at each other and said, that's in the book. So I think part of it is just learning from Mark, you know, how to do on-location research to fill in details that just really fulfill the story.
You have undergraduate degrees in literature. Have you been wanting to write a novel since then?
I've written a lot of junk that no one really wants to read besides maybe me and my mom. So the answer is yes. You know, I think anyone who is a student of literature likes to write, but there's a big difference between wanting to write and writing well.
How did you enter into this collaboration? How much confidence did you have that you might be able to pull it off?
You know, I was really confident when we started out. I mean, Mark's got a degree in political science, and I've got kind of a degree in military stuff. So part of it was we just drinking beer and writing stuff on bar napkins came up with some really good ideas. And so I was confident in the story. The plot line to me was really good. And talking to each other, we made it better and better. And before I knew it, I'm like, holy cow, this is actually a really cool idea. You know, I think really I was confident very much in the story, and that's what propelled it along.
Now, Mark, let's talk about the story idea here. Red Metal is a Russian military operation that's been cooked up by the Special Forces Colonel Yuri Borbikov. And what does he want to do?
Yuri Borbikov was the on-scene commander at a rare earth mineral mine that Russia controlled in southern Kenya. And the mine is wrestled away from them by the West and by the Kenyan government. And Borbikov retreats in shame, basically. And he vows that he's going to sort of find a way back. Meanwhile, the Russian president, his own political fortunes, his personal fortunes, everything's tied up in this mine. Even the national security of his nation, as far as he's concerned. A, it's a big financial boon to them because 60% of the world's deposits are in this mine, supposedly. But he also sees that, you know, for technological reasons, for military strength, they need these rare earth minerals that are used in lasers and guidance systems and computers and whatnot. So Borbikov comes up with this very audacious plan to invade Europe and do a spearhead down into Africa to regain the mine. And all the other generals basically try and hide this plan from Anatoly Rifkin, who is the Russian president, who is a little similar to Vladimir Putin, people might notice. And Rifkin sees this plan and then decides he's got to go for it for all the reasons I mentioned.
This is like the third different stand-in you've had to have for Putin in all your different
novels. At least it is, because I had a guy in the Clancy book. Yeah. He's a good bad guy. And why would you change Russia's bad guy?
But coming up with different names for Putin over and over again must be a challenge.
It's harder and harder.
I was doing a little investigoogling, and I went to mining.com, and they said that Russia has anywhere from the second to fourth most rare earth minerals in reserve in their country. So why wouldn't they take advantage of what's already there?
That's their claim. So I think that we have to be wary of that. China for sure has some claims that we've verified. But I know Russia has come online a couple times. And I mean, I'm not sure you can believe anything that comes out of Russia these days. We've seen all sorts of kind of intelligence campaigns. But, you know, until someone actually goes in there and does a survey, I'm not sure we can believe some of that. So
they're not actually mining them. If they were, they would have them, and they would have an incredible financial boom because they are very valuable. U.S. a couple years ago stopped the one mining operation we had. They're talking about reconstituting it, but it's so environmentally damaging to mine this ore that in the U.S., they're not even letting it happen. You know, obviously Russia is not going to care about the environmental things. Anyone who's seen Chernobyl knows that. But clearly Russia is either exaggerating that, or for some reason they don't seem to want these reserves dug out of the ground if they in fact exist.
I mean, you have to use like an acid bath, like acid rain, to get some of this stuff out of there. So as Mark said, not only is it environmentally damaging, but it's exceedingly dangerous to take some of these minerals out of the ground. But, you know, as we said, if you don't have them, you can't kind of micro-miniaturize magnets and electronics. So it really is the wave of the future. There are 17 different types of them we kind of posited, because there are rare earth minerals in the areas that we call out in the book. But ytterbium is used in lasers. Californium, obviously named after California, is used in magnets. Some of these things are just really important materials. And if you don't have them, your missile is 10 times bigger than it needs to be. So, you know, like Mark said, I speculate that if they have them, we'd be seeing them by now. So I'm not sure that they really exist in the quantities Russia says they do.
Well, and that was one of the points of the article, said that, you know, they produce so much gold, but why have they not gone to develop this?
Yeah, so
I know China has made big inroads into Africa, but was there an analog to this mine in Kenya in real life that the Russians have had pulled out from underneath them?
Yes and no, mostly no. There is a mine in Marima Hill, which is in southern Kenya near Mombasa. It's not Russian controlled. More important to me than the rare earth minerals is the fact that it's just a catalyst for a war, because mm-hmm. there's so much saber rattling between the different nations. Russia's future's in doubt politically and just sort of economically or whatever, and that makes them more dangerous. Obviously, when they were the Soviet Union and more of a like a real hegemon, they were more of a worldwide threat. But as long as they have nukes, they're a worldwide threat. But, you know, I don't think they're going to start like a World War III for any other reason than something that would kick it off. So with all the saber rattling and all the pressure against Russia, it would just take one thing, like the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in World War I or anything like that. And so I was always thinking, you know, with this book, is like, what would the thing be? It could be random. Tom Clancy's Red Storm Rising. It was terrorist attack mm-hmm. at an oil field. There's another great book by Frederick Forsyth called The Devil's Alternative. And, you know, has a similar thing about winter grain in Russia is damaged. And so they have to invade. So the catalyst is less important than the fact that, you know, to show that something would strike a match could be so dangerous.
In the real world, do you think that Putin is doing this just to regain former Soviet republics and create a greater Russia? Or do you think he's just trying to create instability to get oil prices up?
Not just to get oil prices up, but he is trying to create instability. I think he's doing whatever he can to sort of regain. And there's a lot of asymmetric stuff that Russia is doing that we know about with elections and computer hacking and all these different things. And it's all about increasing Russia's strength as compared to the nations around him and as compared to the West. So I don't think it's just for oil, but, you know, that's part of it.
Now, the first person we actually meet in the book is Marine Lieutenant Colonel Dan Connolly. Mm-hmm. And other than rank, do you share any personality traits with him?
Mark says I do. He's got crummy knees. I've got a bad back. So. No, I think if you grabbed any Lieutenant Colonel infantry and reconnaissance officer like me off the streets of the Marine Corps, you'd find that they have these ailments. So there's a couple paragraphs in there that Mark and I worked over for, you know, kind of almost endlessly, where we're describing his ailments and his, you know, kind of giving a background to who the guy was. And we really kind of settled on the fact that this is almost that guy who's just served in any military organization for greater than 22, 23 years. He's hiding his ailments really well, and he's hoping to get promoted again and maybe get another job as a commander, but he also knows that he's worn out. It's just a lot of deployments. Is it similar? I guess so. And in some ways, I hope not, but it probably is.
Generally, with the military, it's advance or retire.
Yeah, promote or die, right?
Yeah. Yep. So how much time does he theoretically have in this story?
Well, he's good. So you're saying, what's his longevity beyond Red Medal? You know, Colonel Connolly, not only is doing the right things that everyone does, but he's gotten some key billets. So he was a battalion commander. And so we made him commander of 3rd Battalion, 2nd Marines, the Batio Bastards, who is one of our most storied battalions. So you kind of get the idea that he's on a good rise. I mean, he's self-limiting. He's got his family back at home and he wants to spend time with them. And he's got these really crummy knees. But I think beyond that, he's very promotable. His partner, I'm sure we'll get into, might not be.
Now, in that prologue, it's 3 years ago in Afghanistan, or 3 years before the main part of the story takes place. And he's talking with the sergeant major after a firefight with some insurgents and an IED. And there's a point where you can almost hear the dun-dun-dun organ come when he talks about the next war America will have to fight. So what is he worried about?
Well, so Mark and I talked about that for a long time. So there are some lines in there that are not just very deliberate, but, you know, they set the stage for the whole story. So we talked about that line for months. I don't know that we got it right for months until finally it got to where it is right now. But Mark said we have to kind of presage the fact that America, this is one of our key premises in the book, by the way, that America has been fighting counterinsurgency for so long. And as a student of history, both of us acknowledge the fact that if you go back through all of our wars, every single time we fight another war, we're kind of still, or we have been in our schools and our training stations, been fighting the last war. And so we're really not prepared for the next one. So that's really where we started in some ways. And so the book does begin and end on that note, which is America is very good at fighting counterinsurgency. What happens if the next war is not a counterinsurgency? And that's a key element of the book.
Do you think there are enough people still left over from traditional warfare to help lead the way?
Well, so that's kind of what we put into Dan Connolly and Bob Griggs and a couple other characters. Certainly in Russia, the Russian characters are that way, is that they have fought many, many conflicts. And so by the time they get into this conflict, not only are they ready for it, but the kind of resident knowledge that you're talking about, is it exists in those older gentlemen. So do we have it in our military? I'd like to hope so. I think that more and more of them are retiring. I've got 2 more weeks left in the Marine Corps, and after that, you know, I'll be gone. There'll be plenty of other guys that are strong and ready and motivated. But some of that knowledge kind of goes away when people retire.
Colonel Borbikov on the Russian side, he's a Spetsnaz officer. Do you think he's doing this because he felt like a personal affront to being dragged out of Kenya, or is it just all for Mother Russia?
Well, it's a combination. If you see him at the very beginning, I think it says that Borbikov really hates this dry, dead rock in Kenya, but he's prepared to die for it because he thinks that's what his nation needs. And then when he's sent away in disgrace, it's just a simple writing technique of creating justification for your adversary's action. That was very important to us. We didn't want the Russians just all be these black hat guys. We wanted their motivations or their actions to be motivated by things that made sense to them. Obviously, I don't want the readers to be like rooting for Russia in this, but at the same time, we have several, you know, key Russian characters who all have sort of their own motivations and personalities. Some are bigger jerks than the other, but it's all a dastardly plan. And if they were just written two-dimensionally, like, you know, their objective is fulfilling their mission and not anything personal, I think it would have rang a little bit hollow.
There's a high-ranking colonel general, Lazar, in there, and he talks about African rocks. And I just imagine Allen Iverson saying, practice? And him saying African rocks the same way.
He sees this as folly, but he is the most storied armor general in Russia. And it's kind of his last hurrah, and it's going to happen anyhow. And, you know, he wants to be involved with it. You do see his, as much character as he's written with, even though he's, you know, on the sort of the enemy side, in addition to him trying to do the right thing for his troops and whatnot, there is obviously some personal ambition as well.
I thought one of the most interesting bits of the book was when the American and the Allied sides are trying to gather intelligence about what might be going on, and they see that Lazar has put his summer home up for rent.
Yeah, that was Rip's idea, and I loved it. And he also had the other general who put his dogs in boarding. And again, I was like, that's brilliant. I love that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because intelligence officers have the most innocuous clues that they key in on. And I'm a infantry and reconnaissance guy, so I'm always in kind of in wonder when the intel guys come back with some tidbit of knowledge like that. So I came up with the first start of it, and then Mark and I kind of bantered it back and forth, and it got just better and better. And the next thing you know, we thought, what are the telltales? The most obvious telltales for a nation that's going to attack are mustering forces on the border. They start bringing in more armor columns. You see troops in locations where they're getting themselves prepared. So those are the signs that we see with satellites or spies, or we see with electronics emissions. So we said, well, that obviously if that happens in the book, America, the West, NATO is going to know what's happening. So we need some really innocuous signs because Russia is very adept at hiding this.
We need some feints.
And we also needed the fact that this is not the grand attack that America and NATO has expected, because we're ready for that. And we're expecting it in a lot of ways. So the intent was, this is a much different type of attack. This is a laser-focused operational raid to take out a headquarters in Europe. So I think for us, those were some neat tidbits. We got to a spot where Major Bob Griggs, United States Army, and Lieutenant Colonel Connolly are talking about it. And that dialogue, both of us wrote kind of very excitedly, because their banter back and forth kind of paints the picture of what's going to happen.
And you even begin the book with the military definition of raid.
Yeah, we had two neat quotes, I thought, in the beginning. One is the joint doctrinal definition of raid, and the other one's a quote from General Rommel, another armored officer from World War II. In the absence of orders, go find something and kill it. And General Rommel did say that. My German's fluent, but I won't bore your listeners with
that. Was that in the North African campaign? Or
he said it when he was in Europe. So he was defending the Western Wall, and he was thrown into the Western Wall to defend all of Europe when the Normandy invasion came in. And there's a lot of interesting backstory to that, because Germany was completely unprepared for the invasion. So he slapped a lot of younger officers who were just hanging out in the countryside, you know, drinking wine, and didn't expect the war was ever going to come to Europe. So he was fairly tough on all of his subordinates.
When the contemporary action begins, it's the last quarter of 2020. So we've set this in the near future. Mm-hmm. And Chinese mainland special forces team is doing a false flag attack in Taiwan. What are they up to?
Chinese special forces assassinate a Taiwanese political figure who is running to lead the nation in the elections that are coming up at the end of the year or the beginning of the next year. The Chinese assassinate him in a manner that it looks like this is an inside job. And the other political party in Taiwan, which is the party in power, is assassinating the political figure who happens to be the most closely aligned Taiwanese political leader with China.
He wants reunification.
And so the Chinese actually assassinate their guy in Taiwan to make it look like the hardliners in Taiwan did it to silence him.
And for a pretext for invasion.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
This doesn't go unnoticed at the Pentagon, and we get to see Lieutenant Colonel Connolly again. As Rip mentioned earlier, he's got a subordinate, Army Major Bob Griggs, and he doesn't seem like the ideal soldier.
the services have, you know, obviously made up of men and women who are of all different backgrounds, et cetera. Bob Griggs, I hope for most readers, is a lovable character because he has done his job for the United States over and over again. And you kind of get the idea that he's deployed downrange to Afghanistan and Iraq and probably lost a lot of buddies. You know, perhaps he's suffering from PTSD. We don't really know. But he's kind of given up on himself a little bit. And so there's around him are guys that are tough and motivated and ready to go. But Bob has some skills other people don't. He's very smart, you know, maybe even smarter than Connolly, although the two of them spar kind of frequently about, you know, the issues that they're dealing with. But Griggs is very well connected. So he has a line in there that Mark came up with that says, where Connolly says, well, where do we do this? And he said, well, if you just embrace being lazy, you find out that everybody's doing a lot of work. You just need to kind of be like a hummingbird and steal the nectar, the intelligence nectar from this guy. So you get the idea that Bob has kind of been there and done that. He is a ranger. I mean, so he certainly, you know, has paid his dues, but he's on the latter half of his career.
That underlines so much in this book. Communication is our key.
Huge.
And that's internal communication and all around.
So there are many characters. This is a very big novel. And the intent is it's an intelligent book. There's a lot of things going on. And wars don't happen because one or two guys. And Mark's fond of saying that if we follow one person and he's on the submarine and then, you know, he's in the boardroom and then he's in the Pentagon, then people kind of see through that and say that's not what's going to happen. So we wanted to have multiple perspectives on the storyline. So the story arc is very clear. What is happening is not that difficult to discern, but the observers are different. So the people who are acting or observing switches a lot to give you different perspectives on things. So you see the Russian perspective. You see Bob and Connolly's perspectives. And in some ways, they're the core because they're the ones who are figuring out what's happening as it unfolds. And be honest, this is not that different from reality, is that a lot of other officers are focused on other things. Certainly the kind of dangling fake flag, you know, operations that China and Russia are trying to throw in front of the United States. So it works. But Bob and Dan are kind of wise to it.
Briggs is more willing to put his career on the line because he doesn't really see that he's advancing.
Well, in some ways, maybe that makes him even more sympathetic. Connolly's still moving on his career. He's got a family. He's looking closely at cultivating a career, making it to colonel, full-bird colonel, and making it to, you know, whatever the Corps is going to give him. Griggs doesn't care. So in some ways, he's the best of the kind of officer perspective where it doesn't matter what happens to him. He's just willing to do what's right to make things happen the way that it needs to. So I think, you know, as much as Bob Griggs is kind of this, you know, I don't want to say washout because that's not really accurate, but he is a guy who is probably more sympathetic because he's willing to do anything it takes to do what's right to make sure that the things that we do as officers are done the right way.
In Mark's books over the years, you've had characters who have problems with the chain of command. And in order to get things done, that's another plot point they have to overcome, is to kind of go around the chain of command. How does that go over in the real world, Rip?
So that's a good question. You know, I'll answer it with a little trepidation so I don't embarrass any services, but honestly, it happens more often than you'd think. And it usually happens at a very senior level. You have officers who are very knowledgeable about what's going on. Typically, they're subject matter experts on something. And they're asked to define a parameter, write a rule, you know, come up with an order, and they realize it's not going to go the way it needs to. So they end up kind of bucking the system and saying, we can't do this. Now, it's a very hard thing for anyone to do. You are swimming upstream at that point, and everyone is looking at you and pointing at you and saying, you can't do that. What are you doing? You're going to break something, and you're wrong. And in the book, we portray it where there's some, excuse my French, some ass chewings. And those are hard because if you're an officer, you've cultivated a good career, and now someone is really kicking your butt because of a decision that you made that you know is right. So those conflicts happen a little more frequently when you get up, but you know, it's the honest guy and gal, it's the person who's really working hard who does them because they feel like there's no other way to get the truth to come out. So Bob Griggs is the guy in this book who, obviously with Connolly's permission and later together in cahoots, they decide to make some things happen that they probably shouldn't have.
In addition to the saber rattling from China and their false flag operation with the assassination of this political leader, some other big news hits the Pacific operation.
Just to make things you know, a little more screwed up for America in this story, a video is released on YouTube that shows an American admiral and an American general in the flagrante delicto.
I don't speak Spanish.
Yeah, so there's an affair between two senior leaders in the U.S. chain of command at the Fifth Fleet. That causes a big shakeup in the military, and they're scrambling to get these positions filled. So it just sort of weakens us a little bit over there. And that combined with other things, the interesting aspect of that is that Connolly and Griggs, who are really looking into this, start to suspect that maybe this didn't come out of China, which is what everyone purports from the beginning, that this is a Chinese intelligence operation against the U.S. And as they start to question that a little bit, there's a lot of pushback at the Pentagon from people that are seeing what they expect to see in a military sense or in an intelligence sense. And I think that happens if you read history, that happens. It's like people tend to go with the thing that they're expecting to happen as opposed to looking in a little bit deeper.
The affair, is that such a big deal because those officers have leverage against them to be blackmailed?
Absolutely. I mean, it's risk of compromise. So, I mean, it's a common thing for the military to train its soldiers, sailors, and airmen against. But it does happen. And in this case, you know, both of them are married and they're caught, you know, in flagrante, as we said. And the Chinese have set up one of the computers to basically, well, we think it's the Chinese until we find out maybe a little bit later it might not be. But the intent is that it's exposed an affair at the highest levels of PACOM. It's not the PACOM commander, but it's an admiral who's about ready to be the chief of staff, which is basically the third in command. And in real life, this happens, and it does shake up the entire command, because when you pull away some of the most experienced men and women from the top ranks and you cause this controversy, everybody talks about it. There's upheaval and confidence is lost and people are not ready to do their jobs. And you wouldn't think that in a modern military it would happen that way, but it certainly does. You know, when you've got the head coach of a football team that gets fired, if you've got the CEO of a corporation that's caught, you know, with his hand in the books, it kind of shatters the whole organization. So that's the intent. It works. And PACOM, the Pacific Command, is in disarray.
Connolly and Briggs decide to go over and talk to one of Briggs' NSA buddies, and it's Dr. Nick Melanopoulos. Mm-hmm. And I'll have to say, I'm glad there's finally a chubby guy who works at a computer that's in one of your books.
He was a fun guy to write, I'm sure, for both of us. So Griggs knows Melanopoulos really well, and he has Connolly come over and they talk to him about this hacking, because he says Nick Melanopoulos reads Chinese email for breakfast. And so he's a character that serves a role from a writer's standpoint to help propel the plot, but he was a fun character to write. And he was an interesting personality. Rip's met thousands, and I've met dozens of these interesting people that work in all parts keeping America safe. And so I know some intelligence people and guys on the analytical side and some on more of the technical side and stuff like that. It doesn't ring far from the truth to me.
Are there difficulties in interfacing with NSA with military intelligence?
Yeah. So it first happened about 8 years ago that we signed into law a policy that says all of the members of the intelligence community must share. And having served before and after that, I can say we're doing way better than we used to. But it used to be that each different organization in the IC would stovepipe its information. So if you wanted something from NRO or NSA or NGIC or somebody else, you literally had to go over to them and say – and fill out a form and say, I need intel on something, even though it might be happening in your battle space, you know, with guys on the ground and they need that data. So yes, it does happen. It doesn't anymore. I'm happy to say we've done much better about breaking through barriers and getting people to talk to each other. But there's still some restrictions. And people still sometimes don't want to share, and we kind of portray some of that in the book.
Did you have to have Department of Defense approval on the content of the book?
You know, so that's a good question. So I know a couple writers, very proficient former military guys, who put their writing through the Public Affairs Division, or they put it through an intel section. I called my public affairs officers. I spoke to them at length and said, I'm writing a work of fiction with another author, and I want to know what I need to do. And they looked up my clearances, and they said, well, you have top secret compartment, and you've got all these read-ons for this different SAPSTO activity, but you are writing fiction, right? I said, yes. They said, well, you know what happens if you violate those clauses? You go to jail. So don't write anything that's going to get you thrown into jail. I said, okay, I got it. Yeah. I mean, is that all? And they said, yeah. I mean, if you're stupid enough to put something on paper that's going to get you into jail, we're going to throw you in jail and throw away the key. This is a work of fiction. Anything in this book is really Googleable, although we, you know, obviously use very modern tactics and techniques to make sure it's exciting.
I can't tell you how many dozens of times over the past 5 years while we've been talking about this book where I'll ask Rip a question and he'll be like, well, I'll give you the non-classified.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's fun because obviously working with Mark, we've been able to find those solutions. So, you know, it's literally like, okay, well, there's a really cool classified thing that would fit in here, but I know I can't talk about it. So let's look for something unclassified that's going to be just as juicy and exciting and, you know, awe-inspiring. And so, I don't know, I think we did that in the book. We were able to find those. Maybe Mark comes up with a plot point and says, we need to go this way. And I'll say, okay, I've got an idea that will fit in there that's not classified, or vice versa.
Now, the vulnerability of modern communications is a big point in the book.
Huge.
Do we have a huge problem?
We do. I mean, so what we outline in the book is not a classified item, but our satellites and especially our fiber optic cables across the Atlantic are very vulnerable. In the book, we only show a few of the cables and a few of the satellites getting taken out. But the intent is really to kind of show the larger degree to which you could create a communications blackout. And so that is the Russian intent. And they very deliberately have different types of assets, both aircraft and submarines. And also we have these computer hackers. So we have these three-chapter section that we're both very proud of, where you're not going to see these characters again, but the intent, kind of as I mentioned before, is this: you're seeing the plot as it unfolds through the eyes of the guys that are actually doing it, not just some general sitting back in the Kremlin. So you see a submarine captain, and he's there. His job is to dissect a couple of these cables on the bottom of the Atlantic. But if you look up on Google, you can find pretty much all the fiber optic cables. They're all listed, and we do maintenance on them, and so people know where they are. And I mean, as a free and open society, I think if you wrote this book in Russia and kind of reversed it and called it Blue Metal, you'd have a tough time because, you know, Russia hides a lot of stuff. But all of our secrets are mainly out there.
So how do you do the research for the plausible way Russia would handle these things?
We basically just sort of war gamed it a little bit and talked about it. Rip had a lot of theories. We had an idea for this plot about a Russian invasion. And, you know, we talked about the rare earth minerals and, you know, how Russia needs to get them back. So we sort of had this impetus for the story. We had our villains, some of the protagonists. Rip invited me to come to his battalion's Marine Corps birthday ball in Las Vegas a few years ago. And we didn't even have a book deal or anything. We were just talking about, hey, it'd be cool if we wrote a book together. And he said, you know, come up and have coffee. I go in his room where he and his wife are, and he's laid maps out on a table, and he has his ceremonial sword because he's going to be in the Marine Corps ball that night, you know, holding the maps down and all this stuff. And I'm so glad that I took a picture of that because I do have it. he's like, all right, so here's how the Russians do what they do. Here's why they do what they do. And then when Rip and I went to Europe to do research on it, it was scary / fulfilling to speak with a former German general. He was like a one-star general who was the last commander of their tank force. We started to talk to him about what the Russians do in this book. And he said, well, there's no way they could do that because there's no strategic surprise. We'd see that happening 2 years in advance, blah, blah, blah. And then Rip sort of laid out the concept of the operational raid, this laser focus that doesn't need that much. I mean, and he really had this look of surprise. And he's kind of like looking off into space saying, well, yeah, that would be good. And he told us in Germany, formerly the bridges were all mined and explosives have been taken out by law. And there's ammo dumps in the forest and all these other things which have been cleared out because, you know, the threat is past. And that was already what our book was about. You know, the weakness of NATO in general and the weakness of the United States in Europe, or the unpreparedness of what it could be. And then we sort of saw that playing out a little bit from a guy that spent his life in NATO.
I mean, this is General Klaus Feldmann was the guy. And I mean, he was a neat guy. We ate lunch at his officers club. He took us to the tank museum. We got to see kind of World War II armor and stuff like that. But what was fascinating about him was, you know, as Mark said, when we kind of showed him this very laser-focused type raid, his eyes widened a lot. And he said, you know, as kind of the sonorous old one-star talking to kind of younger guys, he said, we used to have 2,500 tanks. Now we have 250. Do you think they could stand up against Russia? And we're both like, no, I don't think we could. I mean, that's a tough thing. He said, yeah. You know, I think we validated a lot of our own thoughts just by talking to guys that had been in that job for the past 20, 30 years. And he was certainly one of those characters. You know, it's interesting because we also got a chance to talk to a lot of other folks. We went out, as I think we mentioned, to the 66th Aviation Training Unit out in Nellis Air Force Base and saw A-10 pilots being trained. And that was a hoot. We got to sit inside an A-10. We looked at their missile systems. We looked at their gun system. We got a great photo on the back of the book of us next to the GAU, which is a 30-millimeter cannon, which we talk about a lot in the book. We had a chance where they said, what are you guys doing tonight? And we said, well, you know, we're here for a couple of days of research, so whatever you guys are doing. So we'll come to the hog trough. We said, what's the hog trough? They said, well, you know, the A-10 is called the A-10 Warthog, and so we have this kind of bar. We said, well, that sounds great. We'll do that. So we get in there, and there's a 30-millimeter gun barrel suspended from the ceiling with a bottle of Jim Beam in the back, and there's a little spigot on it. And kind of your rite of passage to be allowed in there is you have to take a couple shots of Jim Beam. So needless to say, after Mark and I passed our kind of initiation, stories started flowing, and Mark and I brought out the pen and paper and started taking notes. And, you know, honestly, we came up with so many really good ideas. Those guys had, you know, obviously the pilots have been doing this for many years. They had so many neat ideas. But one of the biggest ones we confirmed in there, I won't reveal it because you need to read the book, but we have a very important attack that's done by an A-10. And so we said, you know, if you could attack anything, anyone, any other aircraft, what would it be? And they all turned to each other and they all kind of came back with the same answer. And I'm pleased to say we already had that in the book. That made it better and we enhanced it from there. So read the book and you'll see what they attack.
The A-10 is just an amazing aircraft that has been so durable and so long-lived.
We're both super big fans of the A-10. Yeah, and huge. The first time we met, you probably don't remember, but we started talking about it because at that point, they were going to take it out of service, yeah, if you remember that.
Because
yep.
I remember Desert Storm, they even said it was old Desert
right,
Storm.
Right, right. And, and I remember Rip telling me, he's like, you know, there's talk that they're not going to take it out of service, yeah. You know, that there will be a role in it for it. And I'm happy that has been the case, at least this far.
You know, the Air Force, I'm speaking broadly here, so anyone who's in the service, and especially in the Air Force, won't hold me to account for this too much, but the Air Force in general doesn't really like that aircraft. It's an older model, it's an older generation, and they wouldn't mind kind of getting rid of it and upgrading to F-35 Bravos or kind of more enhanced aircraft. Now, there's a small community of A-10 pilots and those that were A-10s that love it. But Congress and America loves the aircraft, and it's very durable. And of course,
and the guys on the ground love it.
Yeah, exactly. Like I was going to say, the infantry guys, anybody who's been on the ground loves this thing because it's like a flying tank, and we even say that in the book. And so you can't take it out just by flak bursts or machine guns like you can with a very high tech whiz bang jet like the F-35. I think, you know, I'm making fun of the F-35 here, but if you shoot a pea shooter at it, you know, it's so electronic, something's going to break on it. Whereas on the A-10, you could lob grenades at the thing all day, and it's still going to fly. You know, and it's still going to shoot guns at you. So I don't know. That's one of the reasons we talked about it. And what we came up with was America loves the A-10. We're putting an A-10 in the book.
We love it.
Yeah. We love it, yeah.
Now, this just isn't America versus Russia. No. And one of the major Russian feints is exposed by a French spy who's in Djibouti, Pascal Arc-Blanchet. He notices some fancy backpacks.
Mm-hmm. That's where it starts. That's right. He was a fun character for me to write, and I'm sure for Rip as well. It was very important to me and to us that not every character in the book was military, mm-hmm. preparing their entire life for war that's happening. You know, there's a lot of civilians, and this is an intelligence officer, but he's basically put out to pasture. He's at the very end of his career. He's, I think, 64, 65, yeah. And he's in Africa, and he loves the Horn of Africa, and nobody else in his service, French intelligence, really wants to do it, so he's doing it. And while he's down there, suddenly one day something happens, and he sees these men and women with backpacks like adventure travelers, but his practiced eye says, wow, they seem a little young to have things. And he finds out what the backpacks are and how expensive they are, and he starts to become suspicious about these European-looking people in Djibouti City, and so he starts tailing them and then realizes that they're Russian.
He has a son named Apollo who is in the French army, but he wanted his son to become an academic. Is there a little bit of your father and you in that relationship?
So I'm hating you for asking that, because Mark and I did a signing yesterday up in Arlington, Virginia, and my dad was in the audience. So, I mean, you know, besides maybe your mom interviewing you for the radio, there's not much more embarrassing than having your parents kind of sit and listen to you as you talk about your creative endeavors. But my dad asked Mark a question, and I think it amounted to, like, how much of this kid's stuff did you have to throw out? Not quite that. I'm demonizing dad. It wasn't quite that bad. But Mark answered back and said, no, he did okay. But, I think it was just a composite. We actually came up with the character before we even thought of the relationship between the two of them. And he is an academic, as you say. He speaks, I think we said, 5 different languages. And that shows up in the character. I mean, he really is the intelligence officer you'd hope would be at the crux of something like this, because he sees everything. And as much as he's kind of a personal mess, drops flaky croissant on the front of his jacket, he keeps pulling at his waistband, but he smells everything in the air and realizes something's up. And so I think that's really the beauty of it, is that he may be outwardly kind of a mess, but he really knows his stuff very well. Smart guy.
And your father's a professor of classics.
He was, yeah.
President of the University of Iowa and Cornell.
That's true, yeah.
Did reading classics when you were young help you in your military career at all?
Someone asked us that question last night. I've never been asked that before, and now it's 2 times in 2 days.
But you loved it.
Well,
you
love I didn't it again. Love it, but I answered it. I'll answer it again, kind of, I guess, the same way I did before, which is, you know, I mean, I had one of these upbringings where other kids are reading Winnie the Pooh, and my dad read us, like, The Seven Against Thebes, and you learn about all the different seven generals as they assaulted Thebes and the seven gates. And so I think, you know, in some ways, maybe he is like that character. But I don't know. Regardless, the greatest aspect is that you do have this relationship. And we don't really have this father-son relationship anywhere else in the book. There's not, you know, a connection like that. So you have a son who's kind of the opposite of his dad, who's a tough military guy. He's made his own career, but exactly, you know, contrary to what his dad is doing. And so I don't know. It makes for an exciting relationship. I mean, we won't go into what happens to the two of them, but both of them are kind of thrust into this, and it's, I think it's pretty exciting.
Both you and Apollo share very big names. I mean, your full name, Hunter Ripley Rollins IV,
yeah.
And his Apollo Arc-Blanchet. They do have rings to them.
Well, you know, I like joking about the fact that in the South, because my family's all from Virginia, we kind of take 3 last names and put them together and then just add a Roman numeral. So you don't actually have a first name for anybody that's born and raised below the Mason-Dixon.
Another very interesting name is the call sign for an Apache helicopter pilot, Glitter.
In a lot of military stories, you have this character who's very junior, typically in the military, who goes into a baptism of fire and really doesn't know what they're going to get into. And we have three exceedingly strong female characters in the book. And I know that in some cases, especially older readers who read Red Storm Rising, you know, having females in leadership roles might be a little tough to digest, but I doubt it. Because what you have here is the same kind of rite of passage story that you have in most other stories. In this case, it's a very junior female lieutenant, an Apache pilot. She's based on real people. We do know several people exactly like her. In fact, we credited one of them in the book. She asked to be anonymous, so we didn't say her name. But the intent is to show that the rites of passage that these people go through, that soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines go through, is defining for them. They get thrust into it. And, you know, we see Glitter, her call sign you can read about in the book, because she has a very funny reason for being named Glitter. She doesn't like it, but most pilots don't like their call signs. Her peers have worse call signs, but she grows into the position. She grows into the job that she's thrust into. She's trained. She's playing video games when we first meet her, but then before you know it, she's shooting Russian tanks.
So what was your call sign when you first got in the Corps?
So in the infantry and reconnaissance, you don't get a call sign. So it's only pilots that get call signs. I went to a reconnaissance school, and so you actually do get call signs at the reconnaissance school. I can't remember mine. It's stamped on a dog tag stuck in a drawer somewhere. But as a reconnaissance officer, you have to go through this kind of similar drunken naming convention. And I don't know, mine was something stupid. And so I don't even remember it. And no one uses it after that. You're supposed to use it on the radio and people are supposed to remember you by it. And they stamp it in a dog tag. But most reconnaissance officers, especially my generation, went right off to war. And that seemed kind of foolish.
Another one of these strong women characters that are in the book is a Polish barista named Paulina Tobias. She had a very quick initiation into the military life.
She's another one of these characters that is not doing this because they want to be there. Not that anyone would want to be right in the middle of the war, but a lot of people, you know, that are in the military are training for this and training for this. She's a 20-year-old woman that works at a coffee shop and joined the local civilian militia to save money for a car. And the war comes to her. She wants nothing to do with it. She wants nothing to do with the uniforms and the, you know, digging ditches or any of that stuff. But the war comes to her. And not because she's Wonder Woman or Rambo or anything, just because of A, happenstance, and B, some inner fortitude when she needs it, she becomes this sort of iconic figure of the Polish resistance. And I just sort of wanted to show a bit of a story arc for a character and not make it super unrealistic or whatever. But she's she was an important character because the average reader, Rip is military and I am civilian. And if something like this, God forbid, should happen in the world, it would affect every one of us. And so I sort of wanted to show her in there in her baptism by fire.
I think if you follow just military characters, it'd be kind of boring. I mean, they obey their orders and they fight and it's painful and people die and stuff. So, you know, by putting these civilian characters in, Mark and I had a lot of discussions about them. They're very developed characters. These are people who, you know, typically would be bystanders but have to do something. So I think it lends a completely different air to a war novel.
I'll have to say, I did wish there was a little bit more action from locals in Djibouti or in Kenya in the story.
Yeah, they got very short-shrifted just because of the size of the book.
Yeah.
There were reasons Kenya wasn't involved. I mean, in the last act, the Kenyans are sort of assuming that the rush is going to take back over the mine and they need the money from the mine. So for sort of political reasons, which is very important, the Kenyans weren't trying to harass the Russians as they were coming down. They were just like, look, we're going to stay out of this because these two world powers are going to fight it out on our territory and there's not a whole lot we can do to affect things. But yeah, you're right. What happens in Africa takes place really in the second and third parts of the novel. And the story has gone wide enough with actions in Europe and actions in Asia and actions back at the Pentagon and, you know, multiple points of view in Africa of the main characters who've already been established. So creating more subplot with other characters who were local was just too big for us.
You know, we started to. So we actually have a guy named Tristan and his wife, who's a Djiboutian woman. And, you know, you read a bit of still left in the book is a bit of her background stuff. But as Mark said, by the time we got there, we had 257,000 words. And Tom Colgan from Penguin said, you guys need to cut. I mean, he was really nice with us, but said, I need it to be around 200. And so, you know, long story short, we ended up with 217,000 words, but we had started to develop some African characters. But by that time, as Mark said, you're in the third act. And I think we had introduced some really solid characters in the last third. Our readership would have, you know, thrown up on us.
Now, there are a couple of questions kind of hanging in the air near the end of the book. Do you think we could see these characters again?
I hope so. We've said from the beginning that Rip and I would like to do a follow-up to this book. It would all depend on, you know, how the book sold and whether the publisher wanted it. So many people are like, is this a standalone or a series? I'm like, well, everything's a standalone until you get the second one. I'm writing the ninth book of my Gray Man series, and the book one was a standalone until they said we'd like another one. And I said, you know, of course. So we'd like to do it. And the pre-sales of this book have been great. And the sales are looking really good. The reviews have been fantastic. So I think there's a good chance of it.
As we did with book one, Mark and I both like having a beer and drawing stuff on napkins. So if you see two dudes sitting there, you know, drinking IPAs and writing on napkins, it's probably us. But we do the same thing for a potential book, too. So we've got ideas. We'll wait and see if the readers love it.
So do you have anything else in the can yourself?
I do, yeah. Thanks for asking. I've got a two-book contract with Kensington. The first book is called Assault by Fire, and it comes out next November. The way I like to describe it is it's a mix between Red Dawn and The Dirty Dozen.
And Mark, what about the next Gray Man coming up in February?
Yep, it's called 1 Minute Out, and it'll be out February of next year, and I've signed a 3-book deal, so there'll be at least 2 more after that. So I'll get to work on the other one. I'm about a week away from turning in 1 Minute Out to the publisher.
Are you going to cut back to 1 book a year and not kill yourself?
I've said that for several years. I don't have another major project for the rest of this year. It's July, and I won't be wrapped up with this for a couple months. So I probably will take a little bit of time off because I've done 2 books a year for 10 years now, and Red Metal is my 18th book. So.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for stopping by today.
It has been
a pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Mark Greeny and Lieutenant Colonel H. Ripley Rawlings IV are the authors of the novel Red Metal, which is published by Berkeley. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.